So I'm going to start this morning by letting our... Pardon?
Cut me own throat, Dibbler?
Yeah. He is a wonderful character. I mean, he is just... He's in a lot of the books. And... We probably won't even talk about him, but you know the fact that he comes in there. But we're going to start off with some wonderful music, and we'll do this both hours and start off with the music, and then we'll launch into things. You'd be amazed at how well it ties into some of these things. Where characters become aware of the subject that darkness is just a place for light to travel.
Yeah,
oh. Mm-hmm. So, put my glasses on here.
All right, that's it.
This is going to be quite a romp, but I think you'll be able to manage with me. I just want to tell you a little bit about Terry Pratchett very briefly. He's a British author. He's about the same age that I am. He's was diagnosed with early onset of Alzheimer's, but he says he's got a few more left in him before it gets too far. But a really grand guy when you read interviews about him on a personal level. But he's thoroughly British. The books are all British, and they use British puns and British humor. But he embraces American lifestyle too in a lot of his stories. But he's written probably in the Discworld series, which is primarily what will be in the readings, probably about 35 in that particular series, and probably another 15 or 20 other novels. He's before we launch into the Discworld series, I'll just give you a little background about it. It's a world where magic is done, okay, and the world is flat there. There are people who keep trying to prove it's not, but then they fall off the edge and their proof is gone. And it sits on the back of four elephants who are standing on the back of the great Atuan, which is a giant turtle, who is swimming through space to a definition only studied by philosophers of what he's going to, where he's what's it all about. And of course, every once in a while, somebody has a reason to or a ability to go over the edge of it and actually see him. So from time to time, it gets proven that he's really there, and the four elephants are still there. Mm-hmm. And within this universe in which Discworld floats on the back of the turtles is it's a multi-universe, and it's constantly referred to as a multiverse. Mm-hmm. Many, many different places, and some places have magic and other places don't. Most places don't, and it kind of focuses on certain places. Well, Discworld's magic is a little different, even places that normally have it, in that most people who can use it really strongly advocate not using it, because magic isn't a real solution. But yet their real solutions work like magic. And some of the characters that we'll talk about kind of demonstrate that. And that's where now, as you read some of these books, you'll get a feeling that Terry Pratchett is steeped in metaphysics and really understands a lot of philosophy and metaphysics. And he does. And sometimes you will say, ouch, because, he doesn't spare anything. And he doesn't spare conventional religion, although he never says anything overtly derogatory about it. It's just that his stories paint such an ugly picture of some organized religions. And where it always focuses at is that faith is in the individual, is with the individual. And the individual is responsible for the individual. And you only see that through his characters. There's no overt sermonizing or any such thing. What I just want to read you is just a brief thing about the turtle. Because you see it in every novel. It's in this. This one kind of captures it. In probably about two-thirds of the Discworld novels will have a couple of paragraphs about the background of Discworld. Through the fathomless deeps of space swims the star turtle Great Atuin, bearing on its back the four giant elephants who carry on their shoulders the mass of Discworld. A tiny sun and moon spin around them on a complicated orbit to induce seasons, so probably nowhere else in the multiverse is it sometimes necessary for an elephant to cock his leg to allow the sun go past. Exactly why this should be may never be known. Possibly the creator of the universe got bored with all the usual business of axial inclination, albedos, rotational velocities, and decided to have a bit more fun for once. It would be a pretty good bet that the gods of the world like this probably do not play chess, and indeed in this case, in fact, no gods anywhere play chess. So that kind of captures it in a short word. His characters, though, are, you get to know them. They're alive. You get to know Granny Weatherwax. You know, we'll look at the list of characters in a few minutes, but it's in them you see his metaphysics. And I want you to take one of these. You may want to look at that from time to time. It's just a little outline, and in the back of it there's an appendix that has information about the characters. Which you can look at anytime you want to. But we're going to have armed guards at the door. It's like when I talk about the characters embodying the metaphysics, I'll just give you a quick introduction here. There's one of the characters called Leonard de Quirm. And he's actually, he's from Leonardo da Vinci. Pardon?
He's not on there?
No, he's not on there. We're not going to talk in detail about him. He's a minor character that only appears a half dozen times.
But
he's
his last name.
Quirm, Leonard de Quirm. And there's D-A. Leonard de Quirm.
Okay.
But he's a genius, and he's always inventing stuff and a little kind of far out there. Oh, yes, of course, that's what I meant, because, of course, you will. Now they're getting ready to go in one of de Quirm's ships to go around because they have a crisis that has to be solved by leaving the disk and going around. Of course, we'll be coming back, won't you, said Ponder. Ponder is a magician that you won't talk about right now. Far too quickly in Rentwin's opinion. I have absolute confidence in Mr. de Quirm's work, and I'm sure he does, too. Oh, dear. It was just de Quirm talking. No, I never to bother to have any confidence, said Leonard. You don't? No, things just work. You don't have to wish. This is him. Things just work. You don't have to wish. He just knows that what he does is going to work. Does that ring any bells? And it always does, although sometimes in quite surprising ways. Before we go into into the characters of the Discworld, I just want to talk a little bit about his youth books. Now, when I say youth books, they're not little kid books. For instance, the Johnny Maxwell trilogy probably is good for a bright middle schooler, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, somebody who's reading. But I love them all. all three of them. And we just take Johnny and the Dead. There are three in this series. Johnny is a young 13-year-old kid who has a rough family life. His in the course of the three books, his mother and father, in the course of splitting up, and very little attention paid to him. But he has three very close friends, and before it's all over with, develops a fourth very close friend with a young lady that joins the group, which is interesting because these three kids are all sort of geeky and don't believe, except for Johnny, who is different, but the one who is the primary game master in the group just doesn't believe girls can do computer stuff. It proves a little bit different when this fourth young lady joins the group. But Johnny is sensitive to a lot of things. He's sensitive to people and their thoughts and their needs, and he's sensitive to a spiritual world that he really doesn't talk about very much. And it's a world where he finds his solace. And in Johnny and the Dead, he's going through a cemetery that he walks through going home a lot and realizes that he can see the spirits of the people who are buried there. And actually talks to some of them, and it leads to quite an adventure, and he's wondering, you know, what they're doing. They meet several of them. One of them was an atheist in his lifetime, and is still refusing to give up the arguments. He said, "Just because I'm here does not negate everything that I've believed all my life." He said, "You know, there's got to be an explanation, but you're here." So, and then there's a fellow who was a Thomas Edison kind of guy who made improvements to the telephone in his life right after Bell had invented the telephone on the British side of the continent. He made some improvements to it. And so he's really into wanting to know about what's going on out there now, but they never leave the cemetery. Mm. Why not? You know, Johnny wants to know. Well, they've been told they have to stay there and wait for the judgment. Well, who told them this? Well, it happens to be a spirit that's been there longer than anybody else. You wonder, why is he telling them this? But they're there. You do find out why he's telling them that. But it's a piece of sadness that caused him to do it. But anyway, because Johnny brings them a radio and an old newspaper, and you know, they start catching up on things. And anyway, without giving you the whole plot, they actually, for one reason or another, try test walking out of the cemetery and discover they can do it. Well, the two guys with the scientific bent go into a phone booth. And they discover modern electricity and phone lines. Ultimately, the people do leave the cemetery because they discover their source. And they discover that they can go anywhere in the universe. They start out by discovering they can ride an electric current and through a line. They can ride a cloud, a thunder cloud. And then they discover they don't need anything, and they ultimately become beings of light. And so it's just in a short little book like that. It's just absolutely beautiful. And
what's this one again?
Well, this is the you can mark it on your thing. It's the Johnny Maxwell trilogy, and this is the second or third one in the trilogy. They're all three here, but they're all wonderful. All three of them are.
You know, it sounds like an introduction to metaphysics.
It is. It really is. You see some of this stuff. Now, he never uses the term metaphysics. He never preaches, but all his books are full of metaphysical morality. Uh-huh. Some people think, oh, you don't have any. Well, we do.
Yeah.
We do. And one of the places we'll read really pins down the underlining. I don't want to go there now. My mind is skipping over there just because it came up. Oh, this is another youth book. Terry Pratchett's Amazing Maurice and His Educated Rodents. Maurice was a cat. The rodents are rats. Now, they hung around. The rats, the principal city in Ankh-Morpork, in this world, is Ankh-Morpork.
What?
Two cities that grew together. Yes, some of the names have interesting logic behind them, but there's the highest institution of learning there is the University for Wizards, which is called Unseen University. It's not invisible, it's just unseen.
It's really like Harry Potter. Harry Potter is just throughout the vibration of this thing, seems like.
Yeah. So, you can see relationships there. But the rats that hang around the garbage dump where the wizards throw out their trash from failed experiments and so forth, sometimes it takes on a life of its own, the trash pile does. And but the rats eat from that pile, and several of the rats discover they know themselves. They become self-aware. And with that comes this intelligence that they, you know, it's just this one large group of rats there by the trash pile. And Maurice is looking in a puddle of water and sees his reflection and realizes that it's himself. And he's eaten one of those rats. Now, and so he was infected with the same self-awareness that they were. Now, what's cute, as soon as he realizes that he's self-aware and he has this, you know, unusual, this intelligence, well, it just changes everything. He's still a cat, though. He's still a cat. So he uniquely holds on to cat values, as do the rats. But it's fascinating to watch it develop. Maurice, of course, now he won't eat a rat without giving it a chance to talk. And so he grabs a rat and he says, just one word, just one word, and your life is spared. And so the way he meets the rats is this one young lady rat says, can we talk this over? And so he meets the rats. And of course, doing a cat-like thing, he gets a racket started with them where they ultimately gets a street urchin, young man who sits on the street and plays his flute. He was abandoned as a baby and raised by members of the Musicians Guild, and then took out on his own as a young boy. But Maurice, the cat, talks to him and to the rats, and basically they start a Pied Piper racket where they go to villages and set the village up. The boy goes in and he's the piper. But the rats are not real comfortable with this, primarily because they've got amongst themselves a philosopher who not only questions moral issues, but questions issues of origin and purpose. And of course, the leader rat, who is, you know, don't like questions. Still, he really listens to this rat, but he feels like they have a purpose and they need to figure out what it is. And through reading some books that they find and along the way, get some ideas on that. Ultimately, it has an incredibly beautiful ending. And I'll tell you, there was a point in here where I wept, openly wept, and I was just, you know, I was just sitting there, and I just felt the tears rolling down my face, and it was something that the cat did for a rat, and it was just so incredibly touching, and I was right there with them. You know, I could see it. And even when I think about it now, I think, that was so good. So this is not only good for kids, it's good. It's a good read for anybody. And Maurice is one hell of a character. And the rat, now I don't want to, I can't go on without talking a little bit about it. This is another trilogy. Johnny and the Dead, the Johnny Maxwell series has never been combined into a single volume, but this was one of his earlier trilogies called the Bromeliad Trilogy. And it's all about gnomes on Earth, actually. It's not related to Discworld at all. It's not a magic book. It's something totally different. Just like this is not Discworld. This is from Discworld, but it's a standalone book. So these are little people. As you can see in the picture here, you see they're actually inside a vehicle, a motor vehicle, and they've got ropes and stuff attached to a steering wheel. So where it starts out in the first book in the series is a small group of them that live in the countryside, and they live in burrows in the hill. And they've really had a hard winter, and their tribe is only down to a half a dozen or so, and two or three of those are very old. They live at a faster pace than humans, so a lifespan of 10 years for a gnome is 100 years for a human. So it seems to them that humans are very, very slow and stupid and dangerous to them because they're tiny, so they haven't. So they, through the leadership of one bright young fella, actually wind up getting into a town, and they spot another gnome standing, you know, underneath something. And they discover that underneath this department store, there's a couple of thousand gnomes. They have a whole life, and they've been there since the store was built. And what's unique about these, so we discover in the course of the books that there are the groups of these gnomes all over the world. You never know exactly how many, but what you do discover that, and you only get to meet three of these groups in the course of the whole series, but they all know that there's something greater than themselves. And they don't know why they know it. And the few that are philosophers among them just know it. And in the department store, they've actually have a priesthood of sorts that evolved. And it's really funny to see how it evolved, because the name of the god is the name of the store. And the signs of the god are signs that are hung in seasonal, and they know the seasons because they never go outside. Because of them, the whole world is there underneath that store. But ultimately they discover their origins and where they came from. And your song, I said, oh man, he's singing about the gnomes. They discovered what moved in darkness. Mm-hmm. And it was all good. You know, darkness is just a medium for movement. And of course, light is there. But so without taking too much more time with that, I just really loved his youth books. And you know, if you just can't stand fantasy, don't even give it a try. But if you think you might be able to get into it because it's got a little humor, it's got a little metaphysics, well, it's a good place to start. And in the Discworld books, you can start anywhere. It doesn't matter. Yes, some of them are produced so that there is chronology involved. You might read some. If you started in one book that dealt with Commander Vines, whose name is Lins, he's the chief of the watch in Ankh-Morpork, and It sounds like
you're talking about your family.
Yeah, I am. he marries and has a son, and he reads his son a book every night, and his son changes his life. He has to be home at a certain time every day, although after he puts his son to bed, he may go back to work because he's a workaholic, but not that I know anybody like that. But he reads him the book, Where's My Cow? So they publish this book, which is a book about a book, you know. Wow. So it's kind of, it's interesting, but it actually is... This is probably made more for an adult to remember than it is to actually read to a kid. Although you could, a precocious kid. Let's see. Did I talk about all this journey in the dead, Marie, self awareness? Yeah. The watching those the critters in this. Come into self-awareness and try to determine what it means is itself a metaphysical exercise, and you'll like it. So there are, as I said, about 35 books in the Discworld series, and so we're going to talk not about the individual books, although in the second half of this thing, how are we doing on time here? I need to
think about 12.
You ding me when it's time to stop, because when I start talking, like when it's time to take a break, we'll take one and then we'll come back. We're going to do some readings in the second hour from the book, and if there's time, what we might do is give you like 5 minutes or so just to thumb through the book, just look for phraseology. And I'm betting that two or three of you will come up with something you'd like to read. Mm-hmm. And if we have time to do that, we will. I did it myself. And, you know, of course, I've read the books, but you don't remember where to look, you know. So I'm still doing a word scan kind of thing. One of the most prominent characters in the series is Death. Mm-hmm. Death, a lot of characters that we think of, that we speak of in personification in our world here, they're alive. Gods are alive in this world because people believe in them. Gods don't come first. People come first, except for the ultimate creator, who... You never hear talk in any of the books, but you hear the small gods talking all the time, and most of them don't really do a whole lot, but they're there because people believe they're there. And Death has been there since anything has been created. And in the series, Death always talks in capital letters. And the interesting thing about Death is that all these eons of experience with people have made him wonder what it is that makes people tick. He knows things because he gets his instructions from a cosmic source that he does not know. He knows when people are going to die because he has their what do you call the thing where the sand comes down through it?
Hourglass.
He has the hourglass for everybody up there in this huge place. And he creates for himself a place to live that is a facsimile of what is on Earth, but it has some significant differences. He actually adopts a child who is rather than let the child die, he decides to adopt the child, and which is somewhat in violation of the rules. He also adopted a manservant, whom he doesn't need, because all he has to do is think something into existence and it's there. Yet he does occasionally like to eat a curry or something, you know. And so, and he wants it to be. He wants it to be prepared by someone, you know. So there are all kinds of stories that wrap around, and he hires an assistant. The assistant is called Mort, and his full name is Mortimer something or other, but he's called Mort in the book about his life. And so he brings Mort back to train him to take his place, because he's thinking, I got to get out of this business, you know. I've got to see if I can have a life. I've never had a life. I've been here all this time, but I'm not really had a life, you know. I just ride my horse, collect spirits. He takes him to the edge, and watching him pick up the spirits, some of whom aren't expecting anything, some whom weren't expecting to die, some who were expecting to die, it's just fascinating at their reactions. What's next? Well, that's up to you. You know, I tell them, that's up to you. He never gives them any instructions about what they go. He says, I'll take you to the edge, and you have to go the rest of the way. And they do. It's sometimes very moving when unless your mind just rejects fantasy. And I would say, if it does, let's meditate on that. Let's get that changed, because it's something special to be able to let your mind wander in. I think it's a gift that Spirit gives us to play. I think each of us is an instantiation of Spirit, our Spirit's way of seeing things 1,000,000,000 different ways. And so we can do that at our own microcosmic level, too, with this sort of thing. But now I'm preaching, and I don't really intend to do that. The books don't preach, but they do teach, and they just give you the opportunity for some fine things. Death has the daughter that he's already adopted, and you know, raising her up, and brings Mort there, and of course they instantly hate each other, which means they're going to get married, and they do, and you know, they do fall in love, and they have a daughter whose name is, and you wonder, how can this happen with the names that her parents have, and you know, grandfather of sorts is Death, and her name is Susan, and she can't understand why her name is only Susan, but she has inherited some really interesting powers, strength, which she does not call magic. She simply thinks of it as knowing. And she becomes a school teacher. She goes to, you know, a university for school teachers, and she does work as a nanny kind of thing, and makes Mary Poppins look light. But she takes her classroom on adventures simply by knowing they're there, and they know they're there. And of course, their parents would never believe, you know, that they sat in a jungle and watched lions and tigers and, you know, whatever. But she was capable of some pretty fantastic things. I mean, we are in a magical world, but it's things that you may have at some time in your life thought, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, there they can do it, because it's this world. But Susan is a really interesting character, and there's at least one book that's dedicated wholly to an adventure of her.
What's the name of that book?
I don't remember which one it is. Let me just look. I hate to... I shouldn't say things like that when I can't follow them up with knowledge.
Well, we can talk
but
about it.
So, yeah, it's so many. Yeah, I tell myself, don't do that, but then I do it. Commander Vimes, you heard me mention a few minutes ago, was another. He's a commander of the watch, a common guy, and he just starts out as the captain of the watch, and there's only two or three members of the watch, but over the course of the books, the watch force grows, and his character grows incredibly because he is a person of such fortitude and moral character and strong beliefs in life. Mm-hmm. And he fights several demons that he fights. He fights a demon with alcohol. And he probably heard it said that the best policemen are able to think just like a criminal. Mm-hmm. It's probably a bad time to say that. Back years ago, I took the civil service exams. This was when I just started school at the University of Colorado, and I was looking for a job after I got out of the military the first time. I took the civil service exams to be a policeman. And out of 800 people, I was the number one on the list.
Wow.
You know, you have to think like a criminal but not be one. Sometimes the line is very fine, and you hear a policeman who crossed the line, and you can bet in most cases they're really angry with themselves when they do it, because it's a demon they've fought all their lives. But you can get past it and doesn't have to be a demon, you know. I come from a long line of horse thieves. But you don't have to go there yourself. The Commander Vimes was like that, just a man of character. Ends up marrying a lady who is she a titled lady and one of the richest people in Ankh-Morpork, indeed, in this world, and an absolutely wonderful person, and just a delight to know, because she raises dragons. Now, the only dragons that they have on this world are very small dragons who belch a little fire every once in a while, have very little control of it, and wreak havoc wherever they are. But she, and so generally they're killed off when they're found. Well, she has established a society for the preservation of these little dragons, and she raises them in his back. So they become inadvertent parts of several adventures, because it's not infrequent that there's an attempt made on Commander Vimes' life, and a couple of times the dragons, through no real fault of their own, administered justice to the would-be assassin. And they're quite humorous in the way those kind of things happen. So he's one of the characters that you really learn to love. And one of his one of the things that he does as he develops his guard force over the series of these books and over the years is he's really into hiring diversity into his guard force. And so one of the people he hires, now this is Discworld, so you got werewolves, you got vampires, but everywhere you've got in the world where you've got vampires that are on the wagon, that, you know, taking oaths and, you know, the same kind of thing, you know, and they're integrating into society. And so Angua is a werewolf. Very nice lady, who is also a person of character. She's a vegetarian. Except it's when she's in her wolf form, which, you know, usually is at least once a month, full moons notwithstanding, will occasionally eat a chicken, a live chicken, which she goes back the next day and pays for. Uh-huh. Because she can't control the urge. Or she pays for discreetly. No, she doesn't reveal herself. Mm-hmm. Because who she is on the watch. In fact, the rumor is in Ankh-Morpork that they have a werewolf on the guard. And everybody knows that it's Nobby. Nobby is not a dwarf. He's just a small, very interesting looking human. So interesting that he has to carry paperwork signed by a doctor that says he's actually human. And so he's quite an interesting character. And he has a life outside of his absurd life on the guard, because he's just a bit of a character who can't resist small pilfering on a regular basis. And he lives, but he's into theater and dance. In his secret life, so he has all these costumes, and so you meet these people and you get to know them, and fascinating. But one of the most fascinating characters, and I believe at one time I read a little bit about this character, and we'll read it again next hour as long as we have time, was a Carrot Iron Founderson. Iron Founderson is actually a dwarf name, because Carrot was his family was was attacked by bandits on a trip, and they were all killed. Everybody in the not a wagon train, but it's not a convoy.
Caravan.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a caravan. All the people were killed, except he wasn't. He was in a basket, and dwarves from the mountains nearby found him and raised him. And raised him to be a very good person. So he's really close to a dwarf, but because of his height and stuff, he has serious trouble in the tunnels and underground, knocking his head off and so forth. But he's quite a character. He actually goes to Ankh-Morpork on the advice of his mother. Goes to Ankh-Morpork. He writes two or three times a week back home, and his letters are really interesting to see what he's writing back to mother. And he joins the watch. He gets an opportunity to join the watch. And he's just one of those people that whatever he does, he succeeds. We'll read a little thing about him in the next hour. We'll read a thing that Angwa says about Carrot Iron Founderson. And they call him Carrot because his hair is red. Mm-hmm. Fascinating guy. You find out that his family was actually royalty, a lineage of kings. His ancestry was a king of Ankh-Morpork. They don't have kings there anymore. Now they're a republic of sort, where it's one man, one vote of sorts. And the one man with the vote is the patrician. And so
okay.
Of course, one of my favorite characters in the book, and she's a metaphysician from the get-go, and we're going to read a little piece about her, and that's Esmeralda Weatherwax. Now, those who know her get to call her Granny Weatherwax. If you don't know her, you don't do that. You know, she.
You must know her really well, but you always.
I do, because I always call her Granny. But she's a woman of character, and she's somebody who knows who she is and what she is and who other. And she's a witch. Edo.
That's your time.
Oh, okay. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back. I'm going to talk about two or three more characters, and then we're going to do some reading.
Cool.
And let anybody else talk who wants to. And if I stay too long on any one thing, just feel free to render a salute, and I'll move on. I know I have the capacity for boring somebody stiff talking about these things. I want to mention a couple other characters, and then we'll go in and do some readings that'll give you a little even deeper understanding of why I love these books. The last one I talked about was Granny Weatherwax. We'll actually read some stuff about her. Rincewind. Now, Rincewind is an... He's Rincewind. W-I-N-D is like Rincewind. He's a failed magician who did not make it at Unseen University. And although he has in him some incredible magic, he is an avowed coward who swears that he's always willing to run, and quite frequently does. On the other hand, he has, at the right time, a capacity for bravery that's astonishing. And he doesn't realize it. He doesn't think of it as bravery. He just thinks of it as something he has to do. And he knows he's going to get killed when he does it, but he has to do it. So, but he never gets killed. He's always successful. He's in a number of adventures, but keep an eye out for Rincewind because his character. He gets given a piece of luggage by a gentleman who's Oriental, and his name was Two Flower. The piece of luggage has thousands of legs and walks behind Rincewind, and is also very powerful, capable of crossing dimensions, does not speak or talk, but is very protective of his master. So the luggage itself is an interesting character. though he doesn't, has no speaking parts anywhere, you know what he's thinking. And then there's the librarian. The librarian crosses virtually all the way. He's the librarian at Unseen University. And somewhere along the way, an accident happens in the library because it's filled with magical books, and sometimes things happen. And there are multiple dimensions in the library for the preservation of certain types of mystical books. An accident happens there, and the librarian gets turned into an orangutan, a 300-pound orangutan, who still has all his sense, but he's still an orangutan, no longer can speak. He speaks to people, and every word that he says sounds like ook. But people tend to understand what he's saying. You know, certain people do. Some don't. But certain people tend to understand him, although it may be a series of just ooks. But he's a very bright sort of guy. Plays a lot of... And he's a fantastic organist. So I'd love to hear him play sometime. Unfortunately, if none. I have heard him in my mind. I've heard him play in my mind. But... he's quite an interesting character who stays the librarian and resists all efforts by the fraternal order of magicians there to convert him back to a human. He's quite comfortable with his status as an orangutan. It gives him a lot of interesting capabilities, but character to watch for in there. Now, there's a collection of characters that are little blue men about 4 inches high, and they're called the Wee Free Men, and they're actually were part of Fairyland, which is another dimension, another magical dimension, but they were basically thrown out by the Queen for being excessively rowdy, and but they're interesting characters who, in spite of their ability to be rowdy, are really good metaphysical characters and do some really incredible things. You love them, let me tell you. You love them. And the leader's name is Rob Anybody. I'll be anybody. The last character I'll mention before we start reading is Tiffany Aching. Aching. A-C-H-I-N-G. She's a young lady that lives in an area they call the Chalk. It's a a high altitude layer. We're not, you may even be, have seen this kind of country where the cliffs in the ground are chalk. You know, it's just, and mixed in it and buried in it is any chalk deposits. You find occasional flints, but they raise sheep. And she is, as a young girl, a natural witch. Her grandmother, Achan, was a witch, but never claimed the rights of a witch. She spent her whole life nursing and raising and administering to the farmer's sheep. He would be called in the any hour of the day to find a sheep. So although you never know her grandmother as a living character, you know her from flashbacks. And, you know, and she would have really been a Granny Weatherwax would have really liked this lady. And but Tiffany is an astonishing young lady, and you really want to read novels about her because of the things that she does, and you just. So that's enough about characters. I could go on about all of them. I just wanted to talk briefly about some of my favorite ones. What we're going to do first is I'm just... This book here that you see me reading from is The Wit and Wisdom of Discworld. And what it is, it's clippings from most of the books. All the books that had been written up to this point, there's a, you know, a chapter, and so the text is right out of here. So I just am using this for ease of use, although not everything I wanted to read is in here. It's just easier, and there's so much to read, I'm not going to take the time. I've marked it. Some of you might even have a book with a thing sticking out of it like that, where this is a thing on belief. You heard me say something that so it comes from the book Reaper Man. Is anybody holding Reaper Man? People get exactly the wrong idea about belief. They think it works back to front. They think the sequence is first the object, then the belief. And you have to have the thing before you believe it's there. In fact, it works the other way. Belief sloshes around in the firmament like lumps of clay spiraling into a potter's wheel. That's how gods get created, for example. They clearly must be created by their own believers, because a brief resume of their of the lives of the gods suggests that their origins certainly couldn't be divine.
That's good.
But I like that. I mean, it already exists out there. It's sloshing around in the firmament. All you have to do is believe it into existence. Did it ring a bell? Let's read something about Granny Weatherwax. I'm trying to be selective here because I know we're 21. I couldn't figure out any really fast way to do this. Gonna read a couple of things about her. The old woman had a flat, measured way of speaking sometimes. It was the kind of voice the Creator had probably used. Whether there was magic in it or just headology. Headology is what she called psychology. What's better than magic, she says, is a little headology, psychology. It ruled out any possibility of argument. It made it clear that whatever it was talking about, this is her voice, was exactly how things should be. She believed that, too. Hey, let's read about hell.
Yeah. Let's hear what he said.
Hell, it has been suggested, is other people. This has always come as a bit of a surprise to many working demons who had always thought hell was sticking sharp things into people and pushing them into lakes of blood and so on and so forth. This is because demons, like most people, have failed to distinguish between the body and the soul. The fact was that, as droves of demon kings had noticed, there was a limit to what you could do to a soul. Example, red hot tweezers, because even fairly evil and corrupt souls were bright enough to realize that since they didn't have the concomitant body and nerve endings attached to them, there was no real reason, other than force of habit, why they should suffer excruciating agony. And have to suffer if they don't want to. Right. Now, some choose to suffer anyway. So they didn't. Demons went on doing it anyway because numb and mindless stupidity is part of what being a demon is all about. But since no one was suffering, they didn't enjoy it much either, and the whole thing was pointless. Centuries and centuries of pointlessness. Okay.
Even demons can choose bondage.
Well, you know, sometimes we wrestle demons unnecessarily, you know, when we realize, hey, we don't have to let that cause us pain. That's my choice. The demon is there because I let it be there. Of course, that's not as easy as it sounds, is it? 146. Oh, this is that little piece that I read you once before. I don't know if some of you were here. I know about Carrot. And this is Angua speaking about Carrot. Carrot could lead armies, Angua thought. Some people have inspired whole countries to great deeds because of the power of their vision. And so could he. Not because he dreams about marching hordes or world domination, or an empire of 1,000 years, just because he thinks that everyone's really decent underneath and get along just fine if only they made the effort. And he believes that so strongly it burns like a flame, which is bigger than he is. He's got a dream, and we're all part of it, so that it shapes the world around him. And the weird thing is that no one wants to disappoint him. It'd be like kicking the biggest puppy in the universe. It's a kind of magic. I love that.
I know people like them.
Pardon?
I know people like
them. Yeah, of course you do. Connie. And Judy. And Gail.
No.
And Dave. Okay. Here's an interesting little piece. It's not quite metaphysical, but I just like it. All I have to do is find it. Oh, yeah. This is Wrench Wind talking to a member of the Barbarian Horde, which is a great group to get to know, led by Kohen the Barbarian. You sound a very educated man for a barbarian, said Rincewin. I didn't start out as a barbarian. I used to be a school teacher, but I decided to give it up and make a living by the sword. After being a teacher all your life? It did mean a change of perspective, yes. But, well, surely the privation, the terrible hazards, the daily risk of death, Mr. Savalor brightened up. Oh, you've been a teacher too. This one is a little thing in one of Granny Weatherwax's invention, and it's a little bit about it involves death. All I have to do is find it here. Let me read the number. Let's see. 1, 2. gosh, this one's kind of long. I'm going to read it anyway because I really like it. Okay, Granny is always there for people in her village when she's needed, and they call her out when somebody's sick and all kinds of things. So, you know, she answers the door. Maybe you could help us? What's wrong? Mrs. Granny saying, what's wrong? It's my boy. Granny opened the door further and saw the woman standing behind Mr. Slot. One look at her face was enough. There was a bundle in her arms. Granny stepped back. Bring him in and let me look at him. She took the baby from the woman, sat down on the room's one chair, and pulled back the blanket. Granny said after a while. There's a curse on this house, that's what it is, said Mr. Slot. My best cow's been taken mortally sick, too. Oh, you have a cow shed, said Granny. Very good place for a sick room, a cow shed. It's the warmth. You better show me where it is. You want to take the boy down there? Right now. The man looked at his wife and shrugged. Well, I'm sure you know your business best, he said. It's this way. He led the witches down back some stairs. Nanny was with her, too, which is another witch. Back down some stairs and across the yard and into a fetid sweet air of the byre. A cow was stretched out on the straw. It rolled its eyes madly as they entered and tried to move. Granny took in the scene and stood looking thoughtful for a moment. Then she said, this will do. What do you need, said Slot. That's the father. All I require is a candle, said Granny. A new one for preference. That's all. And some matches, said Granny. A pack of cards might be useful, too. The child was brought down in a blanket and made as comfortable as possible. You just leave me in here tonight, and no one is to come in, right? No matter what. The mother gave a thoughtful, worried curtsy, but I thought I might look in about mid... No one. Now off you go. She spent some time arranging boxes and barrels so that she had a crude table and something to sit on. The air was warm and smelled of bovine flatulence. Periodically, she checked the health of both patients, although there was little enough to check. She waited a little longer, then lit the candle. Its cheery flame gave the place a warm and comforting glow. After some immeasurable piece of time, the flame flickered. It would have passed unnoticed by anyone who hadn't been concentrating on it for a while. She took a deep breath. Good morning, said Granny Weatherwax. Good morning, all capital letters, said a voice by her ear. Uh-oh. Granny breathed out slowly. Come and sit where I can see you. It's Granny talking to death. That's good manners, and let me tell you right now, I ain't at all afraid of you. The tall, black-robed figure walked across the floor and sat down on a handy barrel, leaning its scythe against the wall. Then it pushed back its hood. Granny folded her arms and stared calmly at the visitor, meeting his gaze, eye to socket. Death leaned forward. The candlelight raised new shadows on his skull. All caps. Courage is easy by candlelight. Your faith, I suspect, is in the flame. Granny leaned forward and blew the candle out. Then she folded her arms and stared fiercely ahead of her. After some length of time, a voice said, all caps, all right, you've made your point. Fair enough, she said as she relit the candle. We don't want to be sitting here all night, do we? How many of you come for? All caps. One. The cow? Death shook his head. It could be the cow. No, that would be changing history. History's about things changing. It was Granny. No. Granny sat back. Then I challenge you to a game. That's traditional. That's allowed. Death was silent for a moment. All caps. This is true. Good. All caps. However, you understand that to win all, you must gamble all. Double or quits. Yes, I know. All caps. But not chess. I can't abide chess. Or cripple Mr. Onion. I've never been able to understand the rules. Very well. How about one hand of poker? Five cards each. No draws. Sudden death, as they say. Death thought about this too. All caps. You know this family? No. Then why? She's betting her life. Are we talking or are we playing? Oh, very well. Granny picked up the pack of cards and shuffled it, not looking at her hands and smiling at death all the time. She dealt five cards each. Granny looked at her cards and threw them down. Four queens. This is all caps. That is very high. Death looked down at his cards and then up into Granny's steady blue-eyed gaze. Neither moved for some time. Then Death laid his hand on the table. All caps. I lose, he said. All I have is four ones. He looked back into Granny's eyes for a moment. There was a blue glow in the depth of his eye sockets, maybe for the merest fraction of a second, barely noticeable, even to the closest observers. One winked off. Granny nodded and extended a hand. She prided herself on the ability to judge people by their gaze and their handshake, which in this case was a rather chilly one. Take the cow, she said. All caps, it's a valuable creature. Who knows what child will become? Death stood up and reached for his scythe. He said, ow! Ah, yes, I couldn't help notice, said Granny Wax, Weather Wax, as the tension drained out of the atmosphere, that you seem to be sparing that arm. All caps. Oh, you know how it is. Repetitive actions and so on with his scythe. It could get serious if you left it. All caps. How serious? Want me to have a look at it? All caps. Would you mind? It certainly aches on cold nights. Granny's hands touched the smooth bone. She felt, thought, gripped, twisted. There was a click. Ow! Now try it above the shoulder. Yes, it does seem to move considerably more free. Yes, indeed, my word, yes. Thank you very much. Death walked away. A moment later, there was a faint gasp from the cow. That and a slight sagging of the skin were all that apparently marked the transition. Granny, I like to mark the transition. Uh-huh. Granny picked up the baby and laid a hand on its forehead. Fever's gone, she said. All caps. Mistress Weatherwax, said Death from the doorway. Yes, sir. I have to know what would have happened if I had not lost. At the cards, you mean? Yes. What would you have done? Granny laid the baby down carefully on the straw and smiled. Well, she said, for a start, I'd have broken your bloody arm. That was a long read, I know, but just Granny knowing. Here's another little clever one here.
This reminds me of the quote that I love so much that says, sometimes people need a story more than food to live.
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
This one is one where Rincewind is having a conversation with Death. Rincewind has a lot of conversations with Death because he's always on the verge of dying. But then it never happens. So Rincewind here. He's talking to Death. Is it true that your life passes before your eyes before you die? all caps. Yes. Ghastly thought, really, Rentwind shuddered. Oh, gods, I've just had another one. Suppose I am just about to die, and this is my whole life passing in front of my eyes. All caps. I think perhaps you do not understand. People's whole lives do pass in front of their eyes before they die. The process is called living.
Well, that's been living. That's awesome.
Wow.
Wow.
What's the name of this book again? For the internet?
Pardon?
What's the name of this book again?
Oh, this is just a collection book called The Wit and Wisdom of Discworld. And it has quotes from it. There's no real commentary in it. It helps if you read the book, so you got a context for it. But it's really, even if you hadn't read the book, just reading through it, you get to know a little bit about the character.
I have a question, Ken.
Pardon?
You must have said this in the early, which I missed. But how did you get interested in Terry Pratchett's book?
You know, that's a really good question. And you know, I don't actually remember exactly what got me into it, but whenever I'm looking for something to read, I look at what authors, and this is more than likely the way I'm getting, I'm not telling you whether I'm sure, but I find out somebody, because another writer has said something favorable about this. I don't know if you've ever read with Wodehouse, Wodehouse, who writes science fiction, and some very unusual stuff. But, you know, I remember reading a comparison that one other writer was making and saying, like Wodehouse. Well, Wodehouse wrote years ago, but I never read him. And so I said, I got to read. It was probably something like that, where I read some brief summary somewhere. Sometimes is that me? Is that
no,
my time?
You have 10 minutes again before.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, then we're going to wrap it up here. But to finish answering your question, it could have been one of my nephews. You know, we are always feeding each other. It could have been one of my fellow readers. Hey, I read a series that you like. Unfortunately, I don't remember how it was, which one of those things it was. Some series I can tell you, but I don't remember.
You seem really excited with it.
It would be one of those. It would be one of those ways.
So now you know how you got started.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so we are actually running out of time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we won't do any more reading then. Let me see.
Only in one sense of the word have we run out of time. Only in one sense.
One more, maybe. Because this one is so good, and I just don't want to leave it out. This is one that I kind of promised you I'd come back to, that Granny says. Oh. Doesn't take me 5 minutes to find it.
While he's looking, I just want to mention, I read the back inside cover about the author, a paragraph. I think that's great. And you can read it sometime later or whatever.
Okay. This is what Granny's view of sin is. Now, there's a religion called Omnian in the series. O-M-N-I-A-N. And, you know, as the centuries have passed, there have been some more liberal groups of Omnians come along that debate things philosophically. The more fundamentalist Omnians don't debate, they just lop heads. So there is an interesting debate raging at the moment among Omnians about the nature of sin, for example. And what do you think? And what do they think? Against it, are they? Said Granny. It's not as simple as that. It's not a black and white issue. There are so many shades of gray. Mrs. Granny. There are no grays. Only white. It got grubby. I'm surprised you don't know that. And sin, young man, is when you treat people as things, including yourself. That's what sin is. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more complicated than that. No, it ain't. Mm. When people say things are a lot more complicated than that, they mean they're getting worried that they won't like the truth. People as things, that's where it starts. Oh, I'm sure there were crimes, but they start with thinking about people as things.
Thoughts are things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thoughts are things.
Yes.
Thoughts are things, yeah. Okay. Well, we probably don't have time to look, but to do the little thing there. But you might try it sometime, you know, without even reading the book. Just sort of scan pages and do a quack search, you know, keywords. And
yeah.
You'll be surprised at what you'll pull out. But if you are a mind to really take a romp, this is a good place to go. And lovely metaphysics all the way through it. Mm-hmm.